Okay, that sounds good. This is Steve, by the way.
Okay, Steve.
And let me take the last thing that you just said, why a cell phone causes interference.
Mm-hmm.
And let's go back to the FCC's philosophy of when you're supposed to take in an intentional transmitter and get it certified. And the FCC's philosophy is that they measure the electrostatic field coming off of the transmitter.
Right.
Which is a bit awkward because a lot of people want to measure the power coming off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So now what's interesting is Europe, when you go and get certified in the European Union, they actually measure the power output.
Ah.
Right. But the FCC philosophy is to measure the electrostatic field.
Well, that's half of it. If I remember right, doesn't the European Union also not average over time like the FCC? Basically, the Fourier transforms they use and whatnot end up time averaging what you see.
Yeah.
So you ignore peaks where the European Union looks at peaks.
Yeah, there's a bit of that as well where it's called CISPR, where they want, the European Union wants to look at peaks. So that helps too, but getting back to the electrostatic field and the FCC philosophy, which seems to be a little bit different than the European Union, is that we go back to our high school physics where an electromagnetic field cuts a wire and causes electricity to flow in it. So that gets why the FCC measures electrostatic field. They believe that it's the electrostatic field that causes the interference.
Mm.
So it's this electrostatic field cutting across wires, PCB traces, metal in the enclosure, coils in speakers, that sort of thing. That's their philosophy of what causes interference. So actually there's some truth to that, because if you follow that philosophy, then that kind of helps you mitigate when a transmitter causes problems. And no doubt a lot of people have probably been next to a trucker with 100 watt CB being transmitted, and they hear that seemingly coming out of everywhere.
Right.
And what it's doing is it's coming across the speaker system. And could it be getting into the speaker wiring, the coils? Of course, it could get into the radio as well. And that's also why it gets into grandma's electronic organ.
Mm-hmm.
On that. Usually, if it's a very high wattage transmission, whether it be an illegal CB or even a legal limit amateur radio, and a cell phone is quite a concentrated high energy device as well. And the difference there is it's a portable device, and it's something that we carry with us everywhere.
So taking his example of the organ, if grandma's playing the organ and she has her cell phone in her pocket, it's only half a meter away from the electronics.
Oh, right. I've had that where I've had this portable phone I'm on right now, and I stupidly put it in the same pocket with my cell phone. And I was hearing all of a cell phone, and I'm thinking, boy, the people in that conference room must have their BlackBerries right by the Polycom, which I know is a problem. And it turns out it was me doing it, just because the phones were 2 inches apart.
Yeah. And then Kuman's got another example with microwave ovens next to a cordless phone.
Yeah, you put a microwave next to a cordless phone. The other side, we were talking about this before the phone call. One of the things that our FCC does is they look basically to make sure that all electronic equipment does not cause interference.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look at the reverse, which is, okay, someone else is interfering, how do I handle it?
Ah, that's a good point.
Because if you go to the European Union again and look at CE,
they
look at it both ways. You've got to take your device and bombard it and prove to the European Union that it can handle it.
Right.
I have a good example. Say you put your cordless docking station right next to the microwave oven. Does that mean every time you turn on your oven, all of a sudden your cordless phone is a little bit funny? right?
Right.
The guy that designed the cordless phone never checked that.
Right. I've been through European CE immunity for a semiconductor machine, for a wafer scrubber, and we had a hard time with it, and I learned a lot, and I'm going to refer to that in the article about you can't cut the shields off, go through red brick amp connectors, and, you know, with wires, even though they're soldered to the shield, galvanically it connects, but RF, that's like an open circuit. And the CE, and God, this must have been a good 10 years ago. From about 10 years ago, all my pals who design systems are like, oh no, I can get through FCC, I can get through some of the European radiator problems, I can't get through immunity. I'm having all these difficulties.
Right, and that kind of gets to really where the crutch of a good design needs to go. I think most of the devices we see in our daily lives are consumer devices, and of course the cost is a major factor in consumer devices, and if the certification doesn't emphasize immunity, then they're going to cut corners at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And just like Kuman said, I mean, the FCC, if you buy a device that operates on Part 15 unlicensed frequencies, there's always this disclaimer that says, you will not cause interference, and if you do, you will cease transmitting, and you will accept interference.
Right.
So it's almost as if it's kindergarten rules. And it has to do with everything that's Part 15 unlicensed. Now, cell phones don't fall into that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, I mean, if you go down to Fry's Electronics and count all the Part 15 unlicensed devices there, especially they're getting very pervasive in the home now, your microwave oven, your cordless phone, your Wi-Fi, your Bluetooth.
Wireless network.
Well, that's Wi-Fi.
Yeah, wireless USB, that one of the Cypress things uses 2.5 gigahertz, I know.
Exactly, so...
all the Zigbee stuff.
Right, and of course, a lot of it's being concentrated in the 2.4 gigahertz area because that particular frequency is good the world around.
Mm-hmm.
So for most manufacturers, and in fact, many of these things we just discussed, Wi-Fi, which is 802.11 and its various flavors, A, B, G, and N, Bluetooth, Zigbee, which is actually based on the IEEE 802.15.4 specification,
mm-hmm.
And even cordless phones for some reason, but anyway, most of those are IEEE standards. Cordless phones fall under the DECT standard. And you're going to see a lot of devices concentrating on the same frequency. Now, the FCC basically put those frequencies up and said, here they are, and have at it, and without any real regulation, so to speak, other than what we just said, you accept interference and you're not to cause interference.
Yeah, it seems like they regulate power levels for a device, but it doesn't seem like, hey, if you want to use spread spectrum, if you want to use frequency hopping, the modulation scheme up there, too, that's up to you, and there's all these different schemes, including a buddy of mine who's talking about making a product that uses baseband up at 2.4. So he says, well, it's not against the law. So well, you're going to be real popular with FM baseband up there, and, you know.
Yeah, he will be. Besides, he's got to find... what I tell customers is it's not what the technology will or will not allow you to do, it's what the FCC will permit you to do at those frequencies. So your friend, for example, if he's going to actually market and sell this product, well, it's got to conform to some FCC rule and regulation. Now, most of the stuff that's up at 2.4 gigs falls under Part 15, 247, or Part 15, 249. 249 covers narrowband devices, and 247 covers spread spectrum, frequency hopping, and direct sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to fit into one of these rules.
That's what I tried to tell you. I said unlicensed doesn't mean unregulated. And some people are confused. They think it's a free-for-all up there, and it's not quite true.
Well, in a ways, it is a free-for-all. I'm trying to remember an article. I'm having a hard time. I may remember it as we talk. It is a free-for-all. And the thing of it is, that goes against the typical FCC philosophy for what's called licensed services, where they use a real estate model.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that works and doesn't work, given that you get some entities that have very big money and lobbying groups. Take, for example, the broadcast industry.
Right.
Then you get the people doing the different standards, like the pulse modulation schemes that are starting to become popular. They tend to spread a lot of garbage around a big white band.
With the sight spurs and things?
Yeah, and they're finding that it interferes more than they were first thinking it would.
My home radio buddies are going crazy because broadband over power line seems to be getting into everything, and they're like, wow, just there's all these interfering sources, and FCC doesn't seem to care anymore.
Right.
Yeah, and there was an FCC ruling on BPL just recently up on the ARRL website.
Ah, okay. I'll have to check that out.
I saw a notice of that yesterday, but I haven't had a chance to read it. I'm a ham, by the way.
Oh, neat.
If you don't mind, maybe we could switch gears a little bit. We've been focusing a lot on the standards, but I think there's another huge element here. When I first joined Microchip 6-7 years ago, I taught a class on printed circuit board design. This is Cuman, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And after one of the classes, I talked to a gentleman from Otis Elevator. And he says, I really need this class. And I said, oh, come on, elevators, what's the fastest you have to go? 10 hertz? You know. And he laughed, and he says, that's true, but nobody designs slow microprocessors anymore. And he is talking about the environment where people are carrying phones and other devices. He says, today I've got to design into the tens of megahertz range on my boards and my electronic equipment to make it work right and be robust.
Wow.
A great story.
Yeah, that's, you know, it gets to that, we're all RF engineers now, whether we like it or not.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, we have a huge pool of engineers that have great experience, but that experience is kind of weak in the RF side.
Mm-hmm.
They lack the training, they lack the experience, they lack the knowledge of how to use those tools.
Paul, you might be familiar that Microchip annually has a big conference we call our Masters Conference in the summer.
Right.
And what we do is we kind of dream up the kinds of classes we want to teach, and they're usually based upon, you know, customer inputs. And over the past several years, we've created classes on PCB design, EMC, EMI, and I'll tell you what, the sign-ups for those classes absolutely overwhelmed us.
Yeah.
We could not believe it.
It's not just me having these troubles.
Everybody is.
Well, let me ask a little, I don't know if Michelle wants to talk about this, but I've got a buddy that works at Union Tech, and I say, yeah, I'm working on this article with you guys, and he is totally dismissive, like, I tell customers to measure it. It's their problem. You know, it's not in the chip, but in fact, you can do things on a chip. Like if an op-amp's a bipolar op-amp, those are the ones that are really susceptible. And you can put big ESD capacity structures, you can play some games to make your chip a little better than the next guy's, but this is more a systems problem. And a lot of the semiconductor companies, I'm really pleased talking to you guys, because I expect it would be, oh, that's a customer's problem, we don't care. And you seem really, really invested in this and really wise about this stuff. And how did that happen with Microchip? Was it just the background of the people who work there, or your ham radio guys?
It's Microchip philosophy. We call ourselves an embedded solutions company.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is when we visit with customers, talk to them on the phone, or conduct training, we basically ask them about the problem they're trying to solve. Instead of the typical, gee, look at our pick. Isn't it a neat little pick? Can't you figure out a way to put this into your product? Where we take the philosophy of understanding the customer's problems, and then we provide them with solutions. And it may or may not even be our products.
Well, Steve, you have to admit that part of it, I think he's right, part of it, both of us have a strong background in RF.
But, I mean, it's still the microchip philosophy.
It is the microchip.
Yeah, that allowed you to blossom and
was trained in both RF and microwaves in college, and my first job I did very high-speed op-amps at a company you've probably heard of, Comlinear.
Oh, sure. Alan Buchholz is still there.
From what I've heard, he's the only one that was there.
My pal's at National, so it was a nice little company until you ruined it.
Okay, let's not talk about that. But anyway, the point being that you know, I was trained on that. All the measurements we made were all done with spectrum analyzers and S-parameter analyzers, and, you know, so I have some experience with that.
Yeah, I've had a RF buddy say, you know, it's analog guys and RF guys think it's two different worlds and two different, you know, I like time domain, they like frequency domain, different test equipment, and there has to be a little bit better, more people like you with their feet in both camps that can help us transition through these kind of problems and just the higher speeds that everybody's seeing on the boards.
The RF guys are being forced to learn regular analog. There, it used to be traditionally you ignored DC because everything was an IF strip or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And these days they're converting everything at baseband.
Oh, yeah.
Times. A lot of amplifiers are connected to baseband. So they're having to deal with it. But anyway, what that has to do with what we're talking about is basically, I think that it's concepts that are missing for a lot of designers. You talked about bipolar op-amps being the big problem with EMI.
Mm-hmm.
That's not actually true. It's true for any type of transistor.
Oh, I thought the base junction forms a detector diode, and the FETs were a little more immune to it.
If you have an electrometer-grade CMOS or JFET, maybe that's, well, CMOS, take that back, CMOS, that's probably true.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But even CMOS, if you take it far enough, will reverse bias. It has a transistor junction there.
Uh-huh.
And almost all op-amps have ESD diodes at the input. And
right.
ESD diodes will definitely rectify and modulate.
Oh, you'll get it there. Okay.
So basically, as a rule of thumb, you just figure that all op-amps can convert any RF energy into a, or even microwave energy into a DC signal.
Mm-hmm. As long as it can come in through the power pins, the input pins.
No matter where
it is. We suspect it can even happen at the output, and WESD diodes, like you say, it just washes through everything and gets into everything.
Yeah, you have feature capacitors, if nothing else, that get it to that point where it rectifies, and then you're in trouble. Yeah, it's a big issue if the board is not designed right.
Yeah, and that's a key thing we have to get across to people, right? That they can't just connect things galvanically and hope it works out. They have to understand all these RF issues.
Well, I mean, you need to be, it's Zen and the art of the electron. One with the electron, my son.
Yes.
All right.
Be one with the electron.
Patrick Johnson's book, The Black Art of Digital.
Uh-huh.
I mean, really, even though that book says that it's digital.
Oh, it's great.
It's
analog. It's great analog.
Yeah, and it really kind of, I mean, in reading that book, it just, I should have realized, but I mean, he makes things very plain that, you know, of course, if you're talking about a digital signal, it has a very fast rise time. You know, that's an RF signal. I mean, if you do the fast Fourier of that, you're talking about an incredibly high frequency signal there. And once you start understanding the source of these interferers, then you can start doing something about them.
That brings up a good point. The classes I've taught on this, it's amazing how many people will tell me, my application is DC, I don't have anything fast, and I'll say, well, are you using a PIC? Yeah. What's the rise time on your PIC signals? 3 nanoseconds? 5 nanoseconds?
Yeah.
And I go through the math and I say, that's at least 100 megahertz. And their jaws will drop. And they'll say, but my application is DC, so that doesn't matter. And I walk them through why it matters.
Right.
There's this conception that if I intend the circuit to work at DC, anything past DC doesn't count.
Right, it doesn't exist.
But the reverse is true.
It's good having that Fourier transform knowledge that if there's a sharp edge or a spike or anything, the frequency components go. That might be a nice little chart to put in the article about, you know, here's a rising edge and here's how much frequency you're going to have to deal with as being significant, you know, the first order worries, as you get the plus.
If you take the rise time,
mm-hmm.
take the reciprocal and divide by 3.
Oh, that's a good rule of thumb you like to use?
That gives you the rough bandwidth.
The other thing I've noticed, people don't realize when you get those fast edges, it injects current all over the place into tiny little stray capacitances. And I see the designers, of course, know that, and they deal with that every day, but a lot of people, you know, their grounding practice isn't good. I always argue with the audio guys who want to do these spinning little star grounds. And Henry Ott, who's a signal integrity, he worked at Bell Labs on their long phone line stuff. He's more like, give me a ground plane and just understand how to place and route things around it so that you can, you obviously don't want your analog and digital mixing together, but it's good to have a reference plane somewhere. So there's so much in board layout, and it's great to see you guys are helping. Yeah, you're not just trying to, here's a chip, sell it. You really are helping people with their system problems. I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, and it's very important they understand it's a system and work it from that point of view. That some, too many times customers come to us after the fact. Then we're on the defense.
Mm-hmm.
Your part don't work.
Right.
And then, you know, we're trying to examine their work and then give them hints as to how they can prove things, but most times they're on a very time crunch. They made a bad design. It's hard to convince them that it's bad.
Right. It's the end of the project, not the beginning.
Right. And I'll tell you what, it's really bad to be on the defensive end. But again, trying to be on the offense, we have a problem where people don't realize it's a problem until it's a problem to them. In other words, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. In other words, if they've never had to deal with a really bad EMI, EMC issue, it's not until their first product that they design that has those issues that they start learning.
And then they think a few Band-Aids will fix it.
And they want to find that silver bullet. You know, what's the one thing that I can do so I can pass? And there is no one thing. Prayer beads.
But I haven't heard them called that.
Yep.
That's great. Well, when I was an auto engineer 20 years ago, one of the things they taught me is if you can, kill the noise at the source. It'll be self-radiated from the ignition and the alternator, the switching spikes. And they're like, no, you don't go and try to keep it out of the radio. And you kill it at the source. And then you don't have it anywhere. It's not in the power of the car. It's not in the antenna. And so that's a good principle. But getting people to just, I've noticed the same thing, that people just want to indeterminately throw little fixes or put things in a tin box. And sometimes somebody says, well, that can be worse. Some of the metal containers actually hold the RF in if it's self-radiating and self-interfering with itself.
Right. So before I forget, before this phone call, Steve was talking about something very fundamental that I think is important, and that is antenna size.
Mm-hmm.
To either radiate or pick up, you have to have a decent size antenna compared to the wavelength of the interferer, right?
Right.
That's one of the reasons why our friends at Linear Tech told you it's not a chip problem, because the chip's too small to be an antenna.
Mm-hmm.
They're right. But if you attach the chip to something that is an antenna, now you have a problem.
Yeah, as soon as you put it on a board. Well, my friend Paul was like, well, you know, up at 2 gigahertz, 3 gigahertz, do the math, the wavelengths, you know, you only need a centimeter or two, and you're starting to get like an eighth wave antenna.
Yep.
And that's enough, right? And you figure a centimeter is a tight layout, and yet it might not be tight enough.
Right.
And then you were mentioning about shielding. Shielding's expensive.
Mm.
I mean, most customers avoid that expense of putting the shield on there. But if you want to avoid that expense, you've got to do a good printed circuit board layout.
Mm-hmm.
And then just be careful from there. But take a look at some consumer devices. If they have a plastic case, if you open them up, you may notice on the inside there's this black kind of charcoal coating. It's actually a conductive paint that can be spray painted on the inside. So in other words, that's another, it could be called a Band-Aid, but then again, you know, some of these things are really difficult to deal with, and you have to do shielding. So take a radio apart. Here's a fun exercise. One night, get with your buds, and don't have too many beers when you try this, is take a cell phone apart, take an FM, you know, an inexpensive desk radio apart, you know, take a ham radio apart, take a police radio apart, and you're going to see a lot of different philosophies in those radios, you know. It's quite interesting. In fact, you've probably seen a lot of the teardowns of cell phones.
Right.
And they've got everything in a chamber.
Right.
In there.
Yep.
Do a teardown on a satellite receiver or transmitter.
Yeah, you get into the gigahertz range, all of a sudden everything's contained in mini boxes. Every little section has its own shield that it is self-contained.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this, of course, has been passed down from engineers for years, and, of course, it's kind of lessons of hard knocks.
Right.
What we do see today, though, is we do have a lot of simulation software out there now. Now, that's a plus and a minus. The simulation software, the trouble is, of all of them that are out there, they're all incredibly expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And the learning curve is just phenomenal. And what does it get you? Well, if you've got an incredibly complex design, it can get you closer than if you have years and years of experience and a lot of trial and error.
But it doesn't show you the problems. It won't tell you what the problems are. The designer has to use the simulator in a way that helps them solve the real problems.
And it's almost like using a spreadsheet where it's, what do you call that? I don't want to call it trial and error, but...
Like a Monte Carlo.
Yeah. I mean, you can do... most of the design software, if you look at stuff from Ansoft, the ADS from Agilent, those are probably the two top-tier EM simulations that are out there. And then they come on down from there. Agilent purchased Eagleware.
Right, I remember that.
And, of course, Randy Ray did a pretty good job of that. I mean, you could buy a really nice package there for $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the simulating tool is only as good as the operator.
Yep.
And it's not a panacea.
Right. Right. And really, once again, I'm sure it depends on modeling and lawsuit transmission lines, do you do that? What kind of, it might just come down to people didn't understand that the FR4 they got prototyped is not the same as they got when in production and those kind of disasters.
Right.
Speaking of FR4 and RF, what I've learned through customers is that it's pretty good up to about 2.4 gigs. You've got to do at least four layers with the top substrate. In fact, one customer got it down to 2 mils. I was pretty surprised.
So they are doing that, right?
Or 8 mils.
Yeah, I've been asking the board houses. It's like, I don't need 20 mil thick pre-peg. I need 8 mils.
Right.
So that my line list can come down.
Exactly. Right. Now, what I've learned is that not all FR4s are created equal, which is, of course, what you're saying. And what they do is once they find a brand of FR4, they stick with it.
Mm-hmm. So you know it's Rogers such and such, and that's what you ask for in the fab drawing.
Well, Rogers material is usually, there's a long list of Rogers material, but it's much more expensive than FR4, so you have to find out who the manufacturer of the FR4 it is.
I thought Rogers still made FR4. They probably got out of that a while back, huh?
Yeah, I really don't know.
I'm aware of microwave engineers that use FR4 even up to 10 gigahertz. But they have to do all kinds of corrections for the change of the dielectric constant with frequency, and, you know, just, or the equivalent dielectric constant. And by the time you get to 10 gigahertz, you're no longer a TEM mode, you're now a TE or a TEM mode. So you have to really understand your microwave design to do it well.
Yeah, it seems less critical, like, for the differential signaling guys, because they're like, oh, but our receivers have all this equalization, and they understand how a pseudo-random binary sequence gets affected by the losses in the board, and they can recover a lot more of the, and they're just trying to get ones and zeros back.
Well, once again, we're back to that thing you talked about it. The automotive companies, do you prevent it or do you cure it?
To the symptom or the cause.
Right. I wanted to change gears a little bit. I work with the op-amps a lot, and one of the things I found is that many customers don't understand what symptoms they'll see if they have a problem with EMI. They don't understand that a DC shift can be a symptom. Change in power level. You measure the current through a part. If the power level's off, there's a good chance that you have oscillations or some EMI issue going on. Another one is distortion of the signal, whether it's the frequency shape changes or actually get harmonic distortion is sometimes caused by that. And the best one of all is erratic behavior. It just doesn't work right all the time.
Yeah, I had two friends talk about being in the world was a part meant for cell phone. And he won't tell me exactly what it was. And yeah, it just went crazy every once in a while. There's people in the lab getting calls on their cell phones. And so needless to say, that cell phone chip needed a little work. And like I said, I'm not sure what it was, whether it was a power chip or whatever. And then there was someone else at Cisco that talked about they were doing a system that occasionally had that kind of thing. And I was going to put that in about, yeah, all of a sudden it acted strange, and it turned out it was, they finally realized, wow, that guy's phone just rang. Look, it happened on the spectrum analyzer.
So a lot of people have the impression that if you have RF interference, you'll find the symptoms at RF frequencies, and that's not true.
That's a really good point. I'll be sure to bring that out. Because it is a rectifier diode sometimes doing the trouble, and so I could see that. It would just rectify and add to some node.
Well, also, say you're on something that has a strong nonlinearity like bipolar, you brought that up earlier. One thing that can happen is you don't have to rectify. You could be running class A on a bipolar, but if you have a strong RF signal, you're going to change the equivalent quiescent point.
Ah.
And you'll get different behavior.
Right. I can see it pushing into a higher distortion.
Well, it may not even really be distortion, but a different gain.
Mm-hmm. It certainly won't be what you want.
But basically, the symptoms don't have to be at RF frequencies. They can be at DC, they can be at a few kilohertz, they can just be erratic behavior. All those things, whenever I start seeing that, when I go on the bench, I start changing my time scales on the oscilloscope to both ends, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like really slow, really fast. I look at it with the spectrum analyzer. I look all over the place trying to say, now, what's really going on?
Yeah. Do you guys have a screen room down there?
Yep.
We got two of them.
So they're the craziest thing I saw is, buddy, I had them rated up for the magazine as one of those cube tails we do. He was in a receiver for this ESL, you know, government spy plane stuff, and he had this 60 hertz somewhere in a synthesizer or somewhere, and it turned out he had the diode was painted black, but it had clear ends on it, so the fluorescent lights were getting in to the end of the diode. And he just assumed that, well, it's a painted diode, it's not coming from there, and he had it in the screen room. He had the test equipment outside coming through, you know, leads, so there was no AC whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
But once again, that's pretty impressive that, you know, you guys are committed to the system enough to have all of this high zoot stuff to help people solve their problems.
Well, we try to teach them how to fish.
Rather than having them call you every 10 seconds saying, my fish.
How to fish.
Easier than to get that panic call, lines down, we can't ship product, and everybody from the CEO down is in my office.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a good place to be.
I think the other thing, too, that I've noticed is that incompetence knows no class.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't matter if it's a Fortune 100 company or a garage outfit. I mean, they can all equally do bad work.
I had my friend call on Motorola in Chicago, and they didn't. He was selling PSOS real-time software. I said, your software doesn't work. Their 5-volt supply was working at 3 because they had so many cards in the card cage, and the plus and minus 12 wasn't referenced to the 5. So the RS-232 didn't work too good. And I said, the real Motorola, the cell phone guy? He said, yeah. It's like, he said, there's no shortage of stupid people in Motorola. So,
Well, we won't say anything about our company. We're all good here.
Well, I did wonder.
If not, we quickly get them upgraded.
Yes. Well, you know, that's part of what I do for a living, is try to help, you know, all the people that aren't familiar with some of these headaches and expose them, and at least they'll know, you know, where to go for help or be aware. Like, I love this thing about, hey, you might just have a DC level shift. That could be RF doing that to you.
Well, it almost would beg a checklist of sorts, you know, to create, you know, if you have problems, and it's basically a troubleshooting flow chart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to just go through. I did want to mention this Tales from the Cube we have. I'm sure both of you guys might have some good stories about a problem that you solved, and we'll pay you $200.
Okay.
And
now, when I read those Tales from the Cube, I just roll my eyes back when I read these things, and they're just almost too outlandish.
Well,
I have something that outlandish.
But at the same time, it brings that familiar feeling of pain. And
yeah.
You know, we've all been in the lab trying to find something elusive and just can't find it.
Yeah, if one comes to mind, you know, what you can do is just, you know, jingle me up or ask Michelle, and we'll get together. You can just describe it to me, and I'll write it, and then it goes back to you, and we'll say, this is completely screwed up, and then we'll write it better, and then it'll go to our copy editor, who's an English major, she's not technical, and she'll make the English good, and it'll be really nice, you know, coherent sentences, and we'll get one more shot at checking it out, and there's $200 for you, so. Like I say, anybody with real-world experience, I'm sure, and I think it reflects good. It's important that we get across, it's like, when the system doesn't work and a microchip parts on it, it's not always microchip's fault. And we're not trying to point the finger at you guys that you designed it wrong, but, you know, look at the RF problems you might get. Think about a 10 megahertz part making 100 megahertz frequency components and those kind of things, where you have to educate your customers a little bit.
Actually, this is off subject, but my experience is the bigger issue with my op amps is that a lot of customers don't understand that op amps are designed to interact with the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll come up and say, I have a problem with drop-in. And I say, I need to see your circuit design and your board layout and your bill of materials. And they'll be really reluctant to send me those things, and I'll say, I don't know what the op amp's doing until I know what it's interacting with.
Right.
You know, a circuit schematic it's pretty, it's nice, but it doesn't tell me what's going on.
Right.
And that's a concept that doesn't seem to be commonly held in people fresh out of college or without much analog experience.
Well, let me put on a subject there. You know, we read a lot of articles about circuits and stuff, and there'll always be a schematic in there.
Mm-hmm.
How often is there a board layout?
You know, that's a great point.
And because I'll tell you what, schematics mean nothing to me now. I mean, there's certain things that are required in a schematic, but you'll see this whamadoo, wow, you know, hey, I just created this circuit type of thing, and it's a schematic, and it's like it's almost like the PCB is where the real money's at.
Right.
My favorite is that magical ground point that are scattered all through schematics, and you go to a board and there is no such thing as a magical node that automatically sinks all current and sources it.
Yeah, my friend, I stole his phrase, he was an ocean of zero impedance. It's just, I wrote an article about
The transmission of electrons.
Yeah, I wrote an article.
The suggestion for EDN is that, you know, start showing the tricks and tips you know, show the actual PCB layout.
Yeah, I'm the right guy to suggest that, because I got it from my mentor, who's, you know, everybody was talking about bus caching techniques in the 68000, and he was talking about, you know, Bishop Graphics black tape, and I'm like, John, you know, you've been doing this, you've been a consultant for all these years, what's the deal with these series circuits? He said, every project, every company he's ever worked on, it always came down to the circuit board. And that was the holdup, that was the problem, that's where the value's added. So that's what I did as a consultant, is, okay, well, give me the thing, in a few months you'll have a working board. And that's what they wanted, that physical hardware.
Yeah, and the thing of it is, there's no college, at least in the United States, I would even venture to say in the whole planet, that even teaches circuit board layout.
Probably not.
Right, you get... You know, community colleges showing how to use the software, but not what we're talking about.
Right.
And I think we need to get the engineers, like, that's how I made money. It's like, well, I'm not going to have a layout guy. I can't afford that. I'll buy one of these little ProCAD as the first one, then OrCAD, now I got Altium. I'll just buy this and do it myself, and for analog, that was almost essential in the old days. It still is in many cases.
Well, you know, if you really do take that up, I think that one of the things that would they're emphasizing is the idea of ground loops.
Mm-hmm.
I found that when I taught my classes, a lot of people didn't really understand ground loops. They'd heard the phrases ground loop or ground bounce before, but they had no idea what it meant or where it came from. So in my classes, I taught them the simple concept that every time you send a current down a wire, you have to trace the return path.
Right.
And the art of the electron.
Yes. So in other words, every time you have current, it has to go through a closed loop.
Mm-hmm.
Stop the loop on the printed circuit board, and you'll be amazed at what's happening, and you'll figure out what's going on and fix it.
Be
right.
One with the electron.
Snatch the electron from my palm, right?
I've had people say, I've got ground plane. I said, well, trace where the current goes. It goes around that cutout for the IC, and, oh, by the way, you had a jumper trace, and it had to go around that, and by the time you're done, you have a huge loop, and they thought they had a nice ground plane.
Yeah.
Well, see, and that gets probably, some people are being conscientious, but they're not getting the whole principle.
They don't understand the fundamentals.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, getting back to basics, it has a lot to do with it, too. I mean, a lot of these college students coming out, if they just get back to basics, but trouble is, I don't blame the students. I blame the professors.
They're taught math courses, and then they have to figure out what that has to do with reality.
Yeah, it's almost backwards.
A paper drill.
It should be, hey, you want to make an MP3 player to put in an outplates box. Okay, now we're going to teach you the math. Now that you're off on that, hey, you had a problem? Let me show you about differential equations, or let me show you about Laplace theory and how that will help you solve your problem. But instead, it's almost like a boot camp of let's brutalize these kids, and some of them won't make it, and the ones that do probably end up to be half-decent engineers. But I do think there's a real gulf in education in that respect, which is something I hope that EDN can fill the void, and guys like us can try to, you know, be professors in our own right. That's why this is a print article I'm working on. I thought it was really important to get it in print. In addition to being on the web, I wanted to get it just forced into people's hands so that they can understand, even if they don't follow everything we're saying, they'll at least have something in the back of their mind. Oh, yeah, immunity. Oh, yeah, RF interference. Yeah, I know that's something to worry about. And then maybe they can get some help or figure out the problem themselves.
Well, and of course, the big issue is trying to get on the offense for these guys. Now, if they're reading your article, you've already got a willing audience that's willing to get on the offense. I wish you could go out there and get those customers that call us up and say our park's broke, you know, because then we're on the defense there. It's kind of also amazing that being an applications engineer, in some ways, we're like a professor.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're the ones that everybody's coming to for answers. And then, of course, we put together all sorts of materials, from application notes to training materials and writing articles, which to me is no more different than what college professors do, other than it's just pure research.
Right. We have the engineers have that practical application, and what I've been deciding lately is that engineering is doubly tough because it's the intersection of science and economics.
What did they say? It's making science practical?
Yeah.
I had a mechanical engineering professor that I think summed it up the best. He said, engineering is the application of science to benefit people.
Yeah, that's well said.
And to make money.
Well, that's, if you're creating value, somebody wants to give us money, so that's good.
That keeps the economy flowing.
Such as it is. Well, this is good. I want to come down and visit you guys. I've been promising Michelle to do that.
That'd be great.
And I'm starting to get, I'm getting a little better at my job, so I'm getting a little more time. I'm working ahead on the blog finally. And so hopefully I'll just be able to jump on a plane and come down there for a couple of days and then zip back out.
That'd be great. We'd be happy to work with you on that. So, just give me a little notice. Let me know what you're interested in, and we can see what we can do.
Okay, that would be great. That would be great. You guys have been a great help. I try to send back, like when I quote you, I try to send back a thing to make sure I didn't misquote you. Sometimes it doesn't happen when we're so late, but I certainly want to mention, because I think it's really important that Microchip is actually taking upon itself to worry about the system, as opposed to, you make little black plastic things, that's the end of it.
Now, are you going to put in your article that the linear tech guy says it's not his problem?
God, I might put it in my blog, I won't mention it by name. I won't mention it by name, but I will allude to the fact that, some, quote-unquote, semiconductor companies don't think it's their problem. And there's bigger companies, way bigger, that I've gotten the same thing from, maybe in the Boston area. And I just feel, it's a system thing that kind of fell through the cracks, and we don't really have anybody to talk to.
I've worked at that kind of companies, and I can tell you what it is these guys have been doing analog for so long that they believe everyone in the world knows what they know.
Yeah, that preaching to the choir thing, I've seen that.
Yeah, they believe everybody's a member of the choir, and they don't realize that most people can't carry a tune in a bucket, right?
Right.
Well, another thing too, Paul, is I mentioned our master's conference, which is once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Actually do our master's around the world. We give 3 in China. We give 3 in India. In fact, this week, it's in Munich, Germany. It's our first European master's.
Wow.
And there's one in Brazil, one in Russia, and then the other thing is Microchip's extended that to our regional training centers, of which there's one in Mountain View.
Oh, neat.
So if you go up to the Microchip website, you'll notice there's a link for regional training center.
Uh-huh.
So I think we do a great job of training because you can get training from Microchip either at a conference like Masters or go to your local regional training center. And, of course, the application notes, the development tools, and the whole thing. But I think for the prospective engineer out there that's wanting to learn these things, learn what Microchip has to offer, we've got these regional training centers around the world.
Mm.
So you might even want to drop in on the one in Mountain
View. Yeah, see what they've got going on up there. That's great.
Yeah, you'll want to give them a ring. They do different classes at different times, and I'm sure they'd love to piggyback you into a class that you'd like to see.
Okay, that's great. That's great. Well, you guys really helped with this article. I can't thank you enough, and I've got Michelle's contact information. I once again apologize for getting my hours wrong.
Oh, no worries. That happens all the time this time of year.
Well, there are 3 different things. I changed 3 of them, and those were in my mind. Year one, and well, I looked at it, and I kind of looked at the 2 this morning. So off I went to San Francisco to the test equipment.
The issue is the article scheduled for the January 10th or the 24th?
I think it's the 10th. I'm not even sure. I'm almost sure it's the 10th.
Okay. Well, do let us know if you need anything else, if you need us to point you to any app notes or anything like that. We're happy to help out.
Okay, great. I can't thank you guys enough.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
All right.
All right. Bye.
Bye.